Thank you, Judge Casepault, Judge Roy, Judge Connolly, for affording the oral argument today. We've come a long way to ask you for justice, and I think this court can accomplish that with a very thorough reading of the record of the proceedings of that where the mistrial occurred on October 18th, 2006 in the San Miguel County Court. I feel blessed today because I see that the court where the mistrial occurred has a front and center picture behind me, and that's where it all occurred, in the San Miguel County Court, and it was a county court proceeding. As the case ended in a very perfunctory fashion, I was giving my opening, and when I was about a third through, the district attorney made his first contemporaneous objection. And I would like to take a look at what occurred on the record that caused the judge to send the jury out, and then we went into a lengthy colloquy, which is the bulk of the that colloquy was between the judge and two counsel, which was what occurred for almost an hour and a half before the trial judge declared the mistrial. There was never I never finished my opening. There was nothing else that transpired in front of the jury. So a first look at exactly what I said, which was the subject of the only contemporaneous objection by the district attorney, and that was my alleged mischaracterization of the elements of the misdemeanor crime of menacing.
Excuse me, I understood you to concede on appeal that it was actually not just alleged, but in fact you had mistaken the law in terms of requiring a more specific form of intent than the knowingly requires.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's what I did. What I did, I was paraphrasing the CGI instruction. I should have done that, but I was. I mistakenly substituted the word with intention for knowingly, which of course is the classification of a general intent crime, which is what menacing is, and so that's what I did. That's the concession I made. However, I feel that mistake was de minimis and that it was subject to a curative instruction. No time was the district attorney, and of course this has occurred in colloquy. What happened was the district attorney said objection. The jury was sent out. Then off the record, the district attorney changed his objection to a motion for a mistrial. And so
off the record or outside the presence of the jury?
Outside the presence of the jury, he changed his, yes, Your Honor, wait, Judge Roy, what happened was is that we went off the record, and then off the record, first, the district attorney changed his motion to a mistrial. Then as we went back on the record, I think the judge decided to get us back on the record, that's what you have before you, then it became apparent that he was arguing this first element, his first objection, as a motion for mistrial, and that was on the elements of of menacing. Now, when we went through the argument, and then I offered a curative instruction, and the district attorney rejected it out of hand. Instead of arguing why a curative instruction was not proper or why it would not cure some alleged taint to the jury, the district attorney then went on to a second objection without even answering. And this objection was, and this was another move for mistrial, he said, well, now the defense attorney, that's me, is a necessary witness in the case. I'm calling him as a witness. There was a discussion in colloquy, and then we went on, and the district attorney dropped that objection, and he went to his third objection, which was that I had made a statement before the jury regarding the pretrial publicity in the case, and that that was an accusation, and that was grounds for mistrial, and that statement was improper. Now, I think the most important thing about the district attorney's raising that is that there was no contemporaneous objection to the third grounds for mistrial.
Mr. Korn, does there have to be?
Well, I think that if it was so severe as to taint the jury, if it sounded so wrong to the district attorney, then he should have made an objection. I think the lack of objection at that point in the trial, that this court should consider that the people waived that argument as to the impropriety of the words that I uttered regarding the pretrial publicity.
Well, there may be waiver when there's an admission of evidence, for example, if a contemporaneous objection isn't made, but do you have any law to support your contention that the failure of the district attorney to object contemporaneously precludes him from requesting a mistrial?
I would ask you to look at the intention of the district attorney. I think that he had, earlier in the case in voir dire, he had fully developed these newspaper articles to the veneer. He had discussed them, and I outlined that in my brief fully. In fact, it's at page 18 of my brief, page 16 of my brief, part F, and it goes on for two pages. And so that I think that what in the district attorney's mind, what was going on was that he knew that he had set the foundation. He knew that that was an issue in the case. He said so in voir dire. So when I mentioned it, I would have been remiss in my opening had I not addressed the pretrial publicity. The pretrial publicity had greatly prejudiced my client. What other motivation was there for releasing all these criminal justice records of my client other than to prejudice him? And so I think that
well, again, do you have any authority for it? You're asking us to...
No, I do not, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, I'm asking you to look at the motivation of the district attorney. In another sense, and I want to go back to the menacing...
How can we do anything but speculate about what his motivation was?
By looking at the voir dire, by looking at what's on the record, and looking at the very words of the district attorney, looking at that in my opening, I also meant that the district, I mentioned that the district attorney was actually reading from the newspaper article, and that it was the district attorney who raised the issue. So,
excuse me, the district attorney raised it in voir dire to make sure that jurors can set aside anything they may have heard in terms of publicity. Isn't that a different issue than affirmatively bringing in publicity as an element of the case? I think there, in any publicized case, you're going to mention and say, what have you heard, and can you lay it aside? That's a different issue than saying that I want to make it part of the case.
Well, I think if you read the voir dire, it was quite lengthy in this respect, and I don't think that the district attorney was aiming to have the jury set it aside. On the contrary, I think that he was trying to hit home with what was exactly in the article. The members of the array were raising their hands, and they were going into personal details about the defendant and his wife. I think that the district attorney played on that. And I think that by the time he finished his voir dire, that he had fully developed my client's reputation for guilt, that the newspaper articles got him ahead of the game, and that there
why
was...
Why would he want a mistrial?
Excuse me?
So why would he want a mistrial? having so carefully laid the groundwork, why would he immediately ask for a mistrial?
Well, I can answer that question, Judge, but it's not in the record.
But don't we have to speculate about why?
I think that rather than speculate, if you look at his jumping around, every case that I read regarding double jeopardy, there's an issue. Something happens. Someone faints. Someone says the wrong thing. Then the judge and counsel, they argue about the specific issue, whether it was proper or improper, whether it should have been stated or not. But the district attorney, he was throwing spaghetti up against the wall. He was trying to see what would stick. He went from one to another, to another, to another. And so I think that his motivation is in the record, and it comes out that he was looking for a mistrial. Now, and of course, why he was looking for it, what was in his head, how he felt about his chances of winning or losing or where he was, that is speculation. I don't think you have to, I can consider that, but I think you should look at the record and ask, why did the district attorney go from one to another, then back? In fact, the judge...
I've seen a few mistrial cases myself, and this particular problem, it seems to me, is curable by telling you to reassume the podium and tell the jury you misspoke and that the element is knowingly, not with intent, and you apologize and continue. Was that ever suggested?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, several times, and that's on the record, I proffered a curative instruction. The district attorney rejected it out of hand. And I think that's an admission that that district attorney knew that the misstatement of knowingly and intentionally was de minimis. I think he knew that.
What did the trial, the county court, say about a curative instruction?
The judge, the trial judge, I asked her several times to accept the curative instruction, and she just dismissed it out of hand. I never got from the district attorney or from the judge why it was impossible to state my curative instruction. And after all, in the initial advisement to the jury, the judge had read the CGI instruction on menacing. The judge had informed the juror that the words of counsel are not evidence, all that stuff. And so that basically was the proper curative instruction. I thought it was pretty easy. I kept arguing that. It's in the record, and it was rejected by the judge. And
is this an action for certiorari, or is this an action for prohibition?
This is a 106A4 review of the declaration of mistrial. I think I can answer your question. In Colorado, we don't have interlocutory appeals as in the federal system. So the earlier cases, I cite those cases to you if I could remember them, but in the earlier cases from the 70s, this was left open and on how you can accomplish an appeal of a mistrial asserting double jeopardy.
Well, you're calling it an appeal. If it's a
I know I am. That's my mistake.
Prohibition, then you're asking the district court to prohibit the county court from proceeding with a second trial.
Correct. That's what I'm asking. I'm asking this court to hold that in the county court on October 16th, at the declaration of mistrial, the jeopardy attached.
And there was no manifest necessity for a retrial.
And there was no manifest necessity. We objected constantly. I objected constantly. And as a matter of fact, on the objection to declaration of mistrial, my client stood up and actually stated on the record that he was opposed to a mistrial. So, and, you know, I do remember the case that resolved this 106A4 problem was People v. Paul. Now, I want to add that I submitted supplemental authority to this case, People v. Segovia. I think that's really an interesting case. I think it's instructive in this case. And that as to the menacing thing, I would just like to quote from People v. Segovia, 196P3-1126, that was decided in November 2008. And the Supreme Court said, Justice Rice said, summarily, that the trial court summarily dismissed any curative instructions so that the court failed to exhaust other reasonable alternatives. And then she really wrapped it up, I think in my favor, if she said, a mistrial is justified only where other reasonable alternatives are no longer available. And that's Segovia 1133, and that cited Paul at 105 P3628 at 633.
Mr. Corn, could you wrap up your argument? Your time has expired.
Has it?
It has.
Okay. Do I have any time left?
No, you don't.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Diane Arrett, registration number 10187. I'd like to start with a few general remarks, and then I would like to respond to some of the specifics that the panel has raised to opposing counsel. First, I would call the court's attention to the fact that this is a Rule 106A4 action, and standards for those actions are limited. The district.
Is this in the nature of prohibition or in the nature of certiorari?
As I understood it, Your Honor, it was brought in the nature of certiorari, 106A4.
Do we have jurisdiction if it's certiorari?
Well, I think that's, yes, I think you do. That is typically how a person objects to an interlocutory action by a county court by filing a Rule 106 in the district court.
Isn't CAR 21 available?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. There may be some instances in which it was, but in this instance, Mr. Ahern chose to file this action. And I would direct the court's attention to the limited review. It is whether the lower court has abused its discretion or exceeded its jurisdiction. Further.
And that lower court in this case would be the county court, even though we're reviewing a district court review of the county court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the question would be, did the court abuse its discretion in declaring a mistrial and finding basically that there was manifest necessity for a mistrial? Is that the standard?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Do you think that every time a prosecutor misstates the law, that a mistrial ought to be granted?
I don't think so at all, Your Honor.
So what's different about this case?
I think the teachings of our appellate courts are that the trial court is in the best position to consider all the circumstances of the case. The court has
what
a better...
What are we missing, save the screaming that I...
I'm sorry?
What are we missing, except perhaps the screaming that was occurring during the conference with the court?
Well, I think the trial court has a firsthand perception of the jurors, of how the jurors are following the statements of counsel.
Do you think misstating the mens rea is poisoned the jury?
I don't think that
beyond
was...
Beyond the point that occurred in instruction, or making counsel restate the law correctly in front of the jury with an appropriate apology would not have taken care of the matter?
I think the case law says that is committed to the trial court's discretion based on its perception of all
this.
I'm sorry?
Which can be abused.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't believe that happened in this case, and I believe that an examination of the record will show that the county court was deliberate, the county court was responsible, the county court, as opposing counsel acknowledged, gave the parties over an hour, counsel said an hour and a half, at least approximately 40 pages in the transcript to argue not just about the intent standard, but secondly, the charge of prosecutorial misconduct and police misconduct.
Would you concede that that issue, had there been evidence to support it, would be a proper grounds for impeachment that could have been brought out on the officer?
It could perhaps have been, but in this case, counsel acknowledged in questioning from the court that they had no such.
No, I just turned it legally, so it's a different case than Arizona versus Washington. In that case, the Arizona Supreme Court had found there was Brady misconduct. I think that's the case principally relied on by you and by the district court in this case to find manifest necessity. And I think it's, if given that concession, that it's legally proper to bring it out, but just there's a lack of factual support, that seems to me to be different than the Arizona versus Washington case, where there was legally improper, according to the Arizona courts, to bring out the prior finding of Brady misconduct. Would you agree that there's a distinction in terms of the legal versus factual basis?
I think there's a distinction, but I also think the Arizona versus Washington is a very persuasive statement in terms of what happened in this case and in terms of the latitude and leeway that the trial court has. The court, for instance, went into the term manifest necessity, and the Supreme Court essentially said necessity is a misnomer. There are degrees of necessity, and we are not going to require an absolute certainty that the jury would be prejudiced. We are going to require that the court be deliberate, be responsible, listen to the arguments of counsel, and make sure that the court makes a considered determination that the trial cannot go on, that the public interest in having a fair and even-handed trial has been compromised.
Now, the jury wasn't present during any of this.
I'm sorry?
The jury was not present during any of these discussions, was it?
Well, I would say that I have a slight different take on exactly what happened, and I think the record reflects that. The problems occurred both in defense counsel's voir dire as well as in his opening statement.
No objection made to the voir dire?
I think the record reflects otherwise, Your Honor. I'm looking at the record from pages 44 to 63, where defense counsel talks about the 60 Minutes program and the DA running for re-election, and says that it's similar to the 60 Minutes program, where the district attorney was charging the Duke University lacrosse students, and he was politically motivated in filing the charges. And then he brought out the fact that the criminal defendant in this case was running for office and said something to the effect, isn't that the issue to be decided here? Asked one of the jurors that. That juror demurred, and defense counsel persisted and said, well, there's politics in both the Duke University case and in this case, isn't there? And then counsel went into the question about the news.
The jury had been passed for cause, and peremptory challenges had been exhausted before the comment that gave rise to the objection. Isn't that correct?
I believe that's correct, but there were objections throughout the voir dire, and certainly the court could have taken into consideration that there was a cumulative effect, not just that one particular moment in time, but all that had happened previously. And again, I would direct the court's attention to the record in that regard. In terms of the DA's opening statement, I would disagree with opposing counsel. There was a very, very brief reference to the newspaper articles, and the jurors who responded to that said they recalled seeing an article, but all they remembered about it was that the victim did not want to press charges. Now, that shows no prejudice whatsoever to the criminal defendant in this case, because in fact that was part of the defense strategy. If you will go through the voir dire and the opening statement of defense counsel, he even got to the point of saying that if there's no complaining witness, how could that be proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Instead, the DA focused on, said, you just must focus on the evidence. If you cannot focus on the evidence and put aside anything you have heard prior to this, we do not want you to sit on the jury. And the DA was perfectly forthcoming and straightforward with that.
Let me ask you a procedural question. This case was mistried in fall of 06, I believe, October. And the district court 106 petition was filed in early 07. There's no stay order or anything precluding re-prosecution. Is the prosecution just decided to, or is there a stay order, or is the prosecutor just decided to not re-prosecute until the appeal runs its course?
I think the case law is settled that when a party brings a Rule 106, they waive their speedy trial rights.
No, I understand that, but the question, I guess, is there anything blocking the people if they want to say, we're going to go to trial? I think the defendant would have to get some order blocking that, wouldn't they?
I believe there probably was a stay ordered in this instance. My recollection of the county court record is that
that the county court stayed its own hand until these
It may have been the district court. I'm not entirely certain, Your Honor. I would really have to go back and look specifically at the record on that.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, you're saying that the cumulative effect of three different possibilities rendered the mistrial here proper under the manifest necessity standard, and that would be the misstatement of the mens rea, the accusation of prosecutorial or police misconduct, and the potential reason to call defense counsel as a witness.
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the county court discounted the notion of the defense counsel as a witness, and I think opposing counsel verified that.
So we just have two grounds then that you're relying upon?
Well, I think again the court needs to look at the entire record. Arizona v. Washington makes very clear that the court does not have to go through a lockstep specification of what it found to be problematic, but the reviewing court itself can look at the record.
Recognizing that prosecutors frequently misstate the law, also, would you agree that a curative instruction would have been sufficient as to the misstatement of the law?
Your Honor, I would have to say that the case law, and our, including our Supreme Court, very clearly says the issue is not whether one jurist may have decided that issue differently than the sitting court. That is not the standard that is applicable.
It also doesn't answer my question.
Well, I think the answer is certainly some judges would have thought that was sufficient. Other judges could validly disagree and still have met the manifest necessity standard.
Although I think Segovia may bump up against that a little bit, the language in the court's opinion, 1154, the trial court summarily dismissed any curative instructions, so the court failed to exhaust other reasonable alternatives, and therefore it was not manifest necessity. And that was a case, obviously, where defense counsel allegedly improperly tried to impeach a prosecution witness. What did the court say about, or how did the court consider, or how would you say that a curative instruction would not have dealt with the problem of the misstatement of the law?
I think the county court listened carefully to the arguments of both counsel in excess of an hour, which is a long time in trial court chronology. And the defense counsel was unable to convince the court that that would have been sufficient. There was also the problem, apparently, again from the record, that defense counsel kept arguing that he had not misstated the intent standard. There was some reluctance on the part of defense counsel.
So maybe he was stubborn, but the jury only heard one reference, and the court could very well and definitively say, he got it wrong. And if he's not going to tell you got it wrong, I'm going to tell you got it wrong. He's misstated the law. And I guess, apart from the deference, what I'm struggling with, if we're the county court, argue to us why a curative instruction would not suffice to correct that misstatement.
Well, I think the court, if the panel will go back over the record, the court was dealing with the jury in a very trying to be very simple, straightforward, and basic. When you get to the point of confusing a general intent crime with a specific intent crime, that issue shouldn't arise. It has a innate likelihood of confusing a layperson.
Confuse a lot of judges and lawyers as well.
Exactly, Your Honor. I certainly subscribe to that. But again, the Palma-Segovia case, I think there are significant differences between that case and this. In that case, the trial court had sua sponte declared a mistrial and summarily dismissed the notion of a curative instruction. That is not what happened in this case, as the 38 to 40 pages of the transcript indicates. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be prepared and set up on Turney versus Civil Service Commission, we'll hear that case. Okay.